The boundaries of time have been continually altered in ways that we can't even comprehend. We exist in this manifestation of a clockwork society, and it's unnatural.
This is one of the things that I noticed when being in Abu Dhabi around the monarchy is they think in centuries, and you can just tell.
Maybe the greatest illusion of the Western democratic society is that the government's goal is to make things better for the average person. Debt is the monetization of future, and inflation is the devaluation of future or past. Bitcoin offers us a timekeeping system that can't be arbitrarily changed. Bitcoin, I think, is a time framework that could enable civilizational deep time thinking to emerge again.
Welcome back to the Adam O'Brien Show, where I am on a mission to inspire the next generation and do it through this show, which relentlessly pursues objective truth through conversation with Bitcoiners and other truth seekers. Today, I'm joined by Scott Dietels, another good friend of mine. And man, this convo is nuts. We dive into the concept of time above all else. Hot off of his upcoming book, set to release, I think, in April or May. And we just hit so many different concepts. We talk about the concept of time, how time is possibly captured. And this absolutely blew my mind. So you definitely don't want to miss this one. And without further ado, let's jump straight into it with Scott.
Every time we talk, and like, we always end up at not conspiracy necessarily, but just like when you look into it, you'll find other facts. Have you always been this way, or is this, what inspired that when you were like growing up? Like you were probably just like me. I was a nightmare of a 10-year-old to like try to father. And like my mom tells me stories all the time. Like, you were a terrible kid to, because I was always asking questions and like proving her wrong, you know, all this stuff. Were you the same, or what was it like growing up?
I can't remember. I don't know if I was like going all the way back to being a very little kid, but definitely as long as I can remember, just having that next layer of, you know, not being spoon-fed everything you hear and accepting it as like fact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, but I would say things really, like a lot of people, really flipped for me in 2020.
Yeah.
And I actually distinctly remember I had gone down this Pizzagate rabbit hole.
Okay.
And this was like my first rabbit hole of 2020.
Pizzagate was kind of like the first Overton window conspiracy. Okay.
Yeah. And I was like finding some really interesting videos on YouTube and then talking about it to friends, then going back like a day or two later to find them, to send them to the friends, and they'd been removed.
Whoa.
And I was like, this is really weird. That was my first exposure to the idea that YouTube actually curates what you're allowed to see.
Right.
And nothing that I had seen was like takedown worthy. You know, there wasn't even really that out there. And then I found some really crazy stuff. Like, that just motivated me even more. Now I'm like, okay,
yeah,
this is something real.
See, you said this away from me. I'm going to, you know, what else are you going to take away? I'm going to find it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I do think generally it's true that almost nothing is exactly as it's presented to us.
Yeah, what's the saying? There's their side, your side, and the truth, and the three sides to every story.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, I think right now there is someone, you know, who gets to choose the truth, and that's kind of the main issue.
Yeah. You know, we're going to probably maybe talk about it later, but this is, I think, one of the central things. This is one of the big arguments in my new book that's coming out, because we've really also actually done this with time. And it's been a gradual evolution, a process that's kind of unfolded over like 600 years, where time started becoming a really unquestioned thing. Mm. It's an organizing structure that we use for all kinds of like value relationships in society. And we have centralized the authority of really being told what time is and what time it is.
And you mean time, like time it is, like it's 1 o'clock, it's, you know, come over at 2 o'clock, like this kind of time. But are you also talking time macro, or like specifically like the 12?
The concept of time itself.
The clock face itself. Yeah. So then how do you rectify like sundial and like, or is that your argument that we move from sundial, which was approximate time, to like milliseconds on a stopwatch?
Like, it's part of it. You know, like the clock face is a compression of reality. Like, it really reduces a very abstract subject into 12 numbers and two hands.
Okay.
And from there, we think it is actually something that can be measured in these discrete and identical units, which is just a totally absurd thing. And then on top of that, what we have really centralized is being told what those units are. So like most people get their time from Apple. You know, as like timekeeping is actually incredibly centralized.
Okay. Like, meaning like their phone just automatically updates based on where their IP is pinging from.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what's the, walk me through, this is deeply fascinating to me because I haven't, so I have had the perception for a few years. I had an outburst like 2 years ago and my friends called me nuts because I got upset that there's a leap year. Like that just doesn't make, like it's, that's dumb. Seconds should just be a micro facet longer. They wouldn't have leap years and like every, you know, seconds, whoever invented seconds just did a bad job is kind of my take, but you're kind of like blowing this concept of time up for me already. So walk me through first the danger of centralized time is probably what I'm most like deeply interested in.
I think like the overarching danger of any of these things is when we give up our own authority to determine what time is. So going way back, you were talking about sundials and stuff. We used to take time more generally from the world around us.
Right.
And so in that way, time really would have been different everywhere. Like time was a really local thing where, you know,
like, local compared to how do you mean just based on the sun, where it was and at night you kind of had no time. Yeah. It was just sun's down. It's night. Okay.
Yeah. And you know, so kind of the evolution of where this kind of, from there we went to clock towers being like really central hubs in cities that were becoming more and more complicated. And so the clock towers were tall and they were loud and they created like an auditory conditioning system with bells that would call people to worship and signify, you know, certain points in the day.
Dude, I was just in Abu Dhabi and that's still like, it's still prevalent. That's
And then you marry that with the, you know, the visual piece of the clock that everyone can see because it's tall, and it becomes a thing that starts to arrange people. So there was, there's a few different thinkers, Industrial Revolution thinkers that argued.
What do you mean by this? Industrial Revolution thinker?
A few different thinkers from that era.
Oh, okay, okay.
Who argue that actually the clock was the most significant invention that triggered the Industrial Revolution entirely.
Wow. To get people to work on time.
Yeah.
And like really.
And commoditize.
Yeah.
To turn time into.
Money.
An ingredient in industry.
Wow. Yeah. How many man hours? Yeah, totally. Yeah. I use it all the time. Yeah. How many dev hours is this product going to take?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. So these things start to really become like a lattice of interlocking beliefs. And they become increasingly centralized as they become more and more complicated. So we started to need standardization of time when steam locomotives were invented. And it was very dangerous if the clocks weren't matching because trains could crash.
Okay.
You know, so now we've turned time from something that was local into something that was, you know, worldwide.
Yeah.
Financial markets.
Sure.
And, you know, it just totally. Yeah. And so it just is. So where I think it's what's, you know, what's interesting about it is the clock, because we reduced it to this thing that just cycles around and over, it kind of creates this bridge to nowhere. It's just a forwardly repeating cycle to infinity that just is, it's linear, and it forces us into a particular way of thinking that has been called accelerationism. And basically the clock on its own is not bad, but we have sort of resulted as a civilization in a sort of mania that pushes things relentlessly forward, measures things infinitely smaller and smaller. And the output of that is like, you know, the mind starts to conceptualize things in straight lines. And this is the reason why we live in a pile of boxes. Everything is a box.
Yeah.
We hold a box in our hands. All the apps are squares. we're looking at boxes on our
just
box.
Just smaller and smaller. The clocks are round. So that's maybe something we have going for us.
Yeah. And it's just, it is so pervasive. Right? Like we exist in this manifestation of a clock society, a clockwork society. Mm. And it's unnatural because this is the thing, is that prior to the mass proliferation of timekeeping technology, humanity interacted with the real world in a very different way that wasn't related to measuring moments.
How was it measuring, do you think?
Just being...
Just presence.
Just presence.
Energy.
Yeah. Okay. So without clocks, there's no concept of lateness. There's no time discipline. You know, like you can't be wasting your hours if you have no idea how many hours there are. And, you know, the biggest thing, and I'm like, I have talked about this often in presentations and stuff, is what I call deep time technology, which is, can be thought of as an example of intergenerational construction projects like cathedrals.
Right.
So it's only possible for societies to imagine intergenerational construction when they are cognitively inhabiting deep time. So you need to be thinking in centuries instead of in minutes. And we think in minutes.
Yeah.
And this is really where I think, you know, it's a Bitcoin book. Bitcoin, I think, is a time framework that could enable civilizational deep time thinking to emerge again. And this is how...
Just from like a time preference perspective?
Well, so it's like anti-acceleration technology, right? Because nothing in Bitcoin can be accelerated beyond 10 minutes.
Okay. Or like block time.
10 minutes.
Block time. Yeah. Even, I mean, even the block time is not real time. It's like real time.
It's not clock time.
It's energy time. Yeah.
Yeah. And so... what it's doing, I think, is creating an artificial floor on the devaluation of the value of time. Because this is the crazy thing, I think, is time on its own is it would be a lot less of a dangerous like structure for a mental pattern if we weren't pricing that time.
And, but because we put pricing on our hours, like you make so much money per hour or per year or what have you.
Yeah. And we, as we inflate money and borrow from the future simultaneously, we are really doing two different types of temporal transactions, right? Like debt is the monetization of future.
Right.
And inflation is the devaluation of future or past.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so it's this concept. What you just said about wasting time is something that I deeply feel. So you're imagining that if we didn't price time, you would feel less guilty. Like how do you avoid?
So this is the
apathetic problem.
Yeah, that's why I think the buildings are such an important like anchor in the sand, because you just have to imagine the reason why we can't build those things today is because we can't even think in the way that would have been required to build those things. Right. So it's a way of thinking that has evolved over hundreds of years that you were born into. And so it's unconscious and none of us really even think about the absurdity of all this stuff, but it's around us like everywhere. This is how the world runs on clocks.
Yeah.
So what I think, you know, where this can go differently is in the fiat representation of time. I talk about this in DAO Bitcoin. I conceptualize this triangular relationship between time, energy, and value. Mm-hmm. And so that if you think about a triangle where if you know the value of two of the sides, you should be able to figure out anything about the third. And, you know, value really is all value to me is some combination of a representation of energy and time.
Okay.
And
time in the way that we measure it, or just time general?
Yeah, time, you know, how long does it take to build something? How much energy did it take to do it? Like, it's a reduction, but... And so if time plus energy equals value, in the fiat world, the value piece is something that's always changing because the value is not fixed, right? Our units of value are not rooted in anything.
Arbitrary.
Right. But time is fixed. We all have a finite amount of time in our personal lives, and we measure time in months and years and quarterly results.
Yeah,
and,
totally.
Right.
Monthly P&L statements. Totally. And,
time is very fixed in our conception of it. So time is the thing that doesn't move, and money value is always moving. In the Bitcoin trends equation, that gets reversed and value becomes the finite thing
because of the fixed supply.
Yeah.
Okay. Just like, is that it? Is that the pure basic Yeah.
Yeah. So if you think about that, what it's doing then is establishing sort of a permanent relationship or a more sensible relationship between value and time and energy. And then you blow that out. And I think it's, you know, it's kind of like, so what happens when, because if you go back to this idea of buildings, we make almost all the decisions we make around design have to do with the relationship, the cost benefit analysis of the relationship between value and time.
Right.
How much is this going to cost me to do it? What are my margins? What am I going to make if I do it in this time?
How many dev hours? Right. Totally.
And so basically the physical output of the world that we inhabit and co-create together is a reflection of that calculation, of that equation. So if the equation changes, then all of the decisions that go into how we think about making the world around us change too. So we are products of our environment, and then we produce that environment. And so I think this is, you know, I call it cathedral thinking. Like, how do we...
Meaning like super low time preference, generational. This is one of the things that I noticed when being in Abu Dhabi, like around the monarchy, is they think in centuries, and you can just tell. And we think in like really biannual political cycles. Oh, totally.
We have really maximized like disposable culture here. I lived in China, and China is the same. Yeah. You know, they have the longest continuous running civilization is like, you know, maybe who knows how long.
Yeah.
And they do culturally think in centuries as well. Mm. And that's why they've been able to accomplish what they have in the last, you know, 80 years.
Is it also because of the communism? Like, does that, in my mind, communism is like probably the easiest way to corral lots of people together and also achieve the like generational thinking. Like, you kind of need to have a certain level of dictation and control in order to.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't really even say they are a communist country because they just have a centrally planned government where they're, you know, ordinary people don't have the illusion of having a say in who's running it.
The illusion, right?
Yeah.
As if you and I do tea here, right? We've talked about this before, like, and I like, you know, I won't speak for you, but I just don't participate in the democratic system. Like, it just feels like such a waste of energy. It's a joke. It's a complete joke. I'm not even sure that people in the country are the people who are actually running the country.
No, they're definitely not.
Yeah.
They're definitely not. I, you know, and I think like, so at least they know it over there, and having that, having the decision-making centralized enables them to move very swiftly and think long-term at the same time.
So, okay, this is also my, I run between two frames of mind on this because in my mind, it should also be very centrally managed here because we, like, because of the illusion of democracy, which is fake. You and I both agree it's fake, but I feel like we still suffer the downstream effects of democracy, which is like decentralization, slow, you know, is chaotic and not well organized. Is that because the powers at bay actually do want chaos and like it's working, it's just not working in our favor? Or do we have some semblance of choice and maybe we just have to find it?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the great illusions, maybe the greatest illusion of like the Western democratic society is the general notion that the government's goal is to make things better for the average person.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good call. What is the government's goal, do you think?
You know, I mean, so governments are, and I think where we get sideways with democracy ideas is thinking that political parties are competing with each other to
serve you.
Yes. Yeah.
When really it's like they just collude to serve themselves.
Yeah.
The Jagmeet Singh pension is like my favorite example of this.
They're just disagreeing about how to do it.
Right. Like Yeah. It's, you know, if you give someone a knife or a gun to kill themselves with, they're going to kill themselves either way. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And governments are organisms, right? And those organisms are very old. Like the government of Canada is like 170 years old or whatever. And it's the nature of those organisms is to grow in power and try to sustain themselves. Like the government of Canada wants to endure.
Right.
That's its goal.
Yeah.
And
do you think it will?
No.
It looks like we're on the way out.
Yeah, totally. But they want to, you know, and how they do that is by progressively confiscating more and more resources from the people.
Yeah. Which we're seeing play out in real time.
Yeah.
Now all the way down to the point where like, you know, BC is basically under lock, you know, it's basically owed to the, I think to the indigenous or what, I don't to be honest, I'm so bad. I'm bad at macro politics at the best of times. Macro Canadian politics is like on the lowest part of my, of my radar. But what's the end goal for, I mean, I assume they're evil people, either running government or running the government. What's their end game? Is it just to amass power and wealth and pass down to their generations? Or
I mean,
is it demonic? Like I would probably take the view of like, you know, some level of demonic pieces.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, what are your,
I think there's several layers that all have different incentive mechanisms, depending on how far you go up. So there are probably, the ladder is littered with people that are really just trying to line their own pockets and aren't, you know, doing anything demonic. But there are those people too, for sure. I would think, you know, structurally, my thought is like Canada's origins were, you know, as kind of an outpost, a company. Canada was really like a resource extraction company. And I think it really still is. I think Canada's goal is to, strip mine resources and...
like resource extraction, meaning like, you know, depending on when you think it was found, but like it's found, they're like, wow, look at all the water, look at all the forests, look at the trade pipes. Like what are they, because oil, would oil have been, you think, how long is oil, you know, what's the story? The story on oil is 100 years, but it's probably like a lot more than that.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who knows? You know, there's a really, you know, I'm one of these things with like broken history. I've been interested in are these great fires.
Like the Chicago fires famously and LA fires recently.
Yeah.
Okay.
So fire has been like a, you know, thing that happens, and it's happened to like many of the big cities.
Easy to explain away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Toronto fire, Vancouver fire.
When was Toronto fire?
Calgary fire. I don't know them all by dates. Yeah.
Fire, and would you say floods, like the Calgary flood that recently happened? That was it. Maybe almost 10 years ago.
10 years ago.
Yeah. Is that, do you think, is this in the same vein or are the fires different for
wires? I mean, like historically, the great fires have been like really significant. Like the Great Fire of Chicago destroyed like 18,000 buildings in 2 days.
Okay. Whoa.
Yeah. Stone buildings.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Good luck. Hot fire. It's like, hey, my chimney's made of stone. How does that work?
Yeah, who knows? Yeah. So I remember as a kid, CBC used to produce these really cool, like animated shorts, and everybody's seen the Log Driver's Waltz probably. I don't know if you're
maybe
too young. Look it up after.
Okay.
But there was a series of these like short stories about big events in the history of Canada. And one of them is this famous explosion that happened in the Halifax Harbor. And Halifax Harbor, two ships collided, and one was basically like shipping gunpowder or something. Okay. And it was like before the atomic explosions in World War II, this was like thought to be one of the biggest explosions in human history.
Just the compounding effect of gunpowder, basically. Yeah,
and destroyed like, you know, a humongous piece of Halifax.
Whoa. Was it close to shore? It must have been.
Yeah. Okay. And they're like right on shore. Yeah. And, you know, this is just at a cursory glance, a fairly, you know, nothing more to see here event in Canadian history. And it's not called a great fire. It did produce a great fire. And, you know, a lot of Halifax was gone after.
So you'd figure like ancient buildings, like.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of these repeated things, a niche interest of mine with history and these like of his star forts. Yeah. Star Forts is another one of these rabbit holes I found around the same time as when I was looking into the Pizzagate stuff. Okay. Because I've been all over traveling. Like I've traveled lots. I've always traveled and I've always loved visiting these buildings. And I have been to many places where there are Star Forts and not really thought too much about it. Star Forts are, there's thousands of them all over the world. And they are buildings that are thought to be now, or what we're told is that they were, you know, military installations. They are geometric patterns that would be viewed from above. Perfect, sacred star shapes, flower shapes, like impossible geometry, and really incredible. Like there are some in Central Europe where there's also like a lot of earthworks around them. So it's not just the building itself, but elaborate canals and waterway systems. Mm. And
so are these like big Big Beetlejuice. Okay. Yeah. Like bigger than
castles. They're giant castles.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Are they literally castles or are they like that size?
Yeah.
Okay.
Some are even cities. So there's actually star cities. And,
where?
All over the world. They're literally all over the world. There are star forts in, you know, in the Bahamas, in all over Europe, Africa. Like it's like the, like it's just this bizarre thing that for some reason, the narrative says for a few hundred years, maybe like 600 years ago, all over the world, we decided to start building these star-shaped forts that would have been best appreciated from like hundreds of feet in the air, even though we would have had no way to see them at that time, which predated air travel.
So obviously. When you say best have seen them from the air, is that because of the way it's architected? Yeah. And okay, so what's the theory? Talk to me about, like, is this, are we like going down like a Tartaria road? Is it like?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, so to tie the bow on before we, you know, what they're for, there is a star fort in Halifax.
Okay.
Yeah. And
did it get destroyed?
I think the star forts, they're still there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stronger than stone.
Stronger than stone. Well, yeah, the explanation originally was that like the contours of the star made it like really difficult to attack. Like, cause you,
then so it's literally shaped in a star?
Yeah.
Man, I got to see these buildings.
Incredible.
It's in Halifax.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. We should go on a road trip to Halifax. Yeah. Maybe not a road trip. Maybe we'll fly there.
There are better. Like Antwerp, I think, has a really incredible one.
How many would you say there are in the...
There's thousands.
Thousands?
Thousands.
Okay.
Yeah. They're literally everywhere.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so obviously we, you know, like there's no chance we just collectively started building these the same way 600 years ago, in my opinion.
Yeah.
What do you figure is the... Is the reason, or what's who produces these?
Uh-huh. This is the funny thing about buildings, because you can examine them yourself,
right?
You know, and it's like proof of work.
Yeah.
And we have talked about this because we're from Edmonton together, and there is a building in Edmonton that is the now the government uses and calls it the Alberta Legislature Building.
That's popular, right? The government kind of just gets to use all these awesome old buildings.
Yeah. I mean, and it's really the legislature in Edmonton is basically a miniature version of the White House.
Yeah, totally. And the one in Austin, I went and saw the Capitol building in, is it called the Capitol building? What's the one in Austin?
I don't know them all by name.
Dude, but it's massive. Uh-huh. Like, it's out of hand.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure what to expect. You're kind of just walking down this dingy street and then all of a sudden it's like, boom, massive building.
Yeah. You know, I've never seen a building like that built in my lifetime. Like West Edmonton Mall was probably the most impressive building I've ever
seen. Which is pretty impressive.
But, you know, it's this kind of a really fascinating mystery of how buildings like that were getting knocked out all over the world.
7 years.
Yeah. So, you know, and these, really short amount of times. And the style is like, you know, that building in Edmonton also looks exactly like St. Paul's Cathedral in London. And so we were really, and you know, there's buildings in Japan that are the same style, Argentina. So somehow we figured out exactly how to build those buildings exactly the same all over the world, which is in itself pretty impressive. The quality on them is like unbelievable. And even now they look like in many cases, basically brand new. Which is really something, you know?
Like So the time leading, or the time, well, you said Pizzagate rabbit hole leads you down Stargate rabbit hole, or Starfort rabbit hole, and Starfort into Star Cities. I'm deeply interested to kind of, cause these are concepts I align with. Like I personally think it's outrageous that we built the Edmonton Ledge in 7 years. Like it just doesn't make any sense to me. And then you look at like, it's actually a really funny building to compare it to. There's a building on White Ave that's about 100 years old, which is how old the ledge is. Built in 1907, it says. And it's like tiny and rickety and falling apart and made of bricks. And the ledge is, I don't know what kind of quarry it is, but it's like, some insane quartz, marble, you know, like granite display of perfection.
I mean, like, I don't know what... I would love to know what that dome that sits on the top of that building weighs.
Mm, yeah.
But like, are there photos of it being, how did they place it up there?
Well, I mean, I'm sure there's photos now that, like, you know, who knows the legitimacy? I mean, there's photos of everything you want to find these days. But I'm more interested in exploring the concept of like, are we intentionally you know, let's go back to the time one. The time one makes sense to me that it could be just a natural evolution of like the fall of humanity, just getting less and less. We have this theory that, like, especially in like an atheistic world, that we're evolving, but I think we're actually devolving. Like, it seems like we are our own worst enemy. You know, if you read the Bible in any kind of way, it's like clear that there was greatness and then there was the fall and then God redeems. And then there's like, you know, more greatness and then more fall. And like, here we are today. And so I would probably subscribe more to that mindset. Looking back at our history. But one thing I can't rectify in my head is, are we purposefully making time wrong or like corrupting time? How would you categorize like the thesis of your book? Like, is it the way humans corrupt time? Is it the way we've controlled time? Is it the way we got it wrong? Like, how would you characterize it? Maybe what I'm asking more directly is it purposeful and evil, or is it just a mistake?
Yeah, I think that this is sort of what we saw in 2020, where the way it's possible to have an idea system implanted in enough people where it becomes, it starts to self-replicate. And I think that's kind of what happened with time too. Time's actual origins, if you kind of go back, and I talk about this in the book, the earliest conceptions of time as a boundary come from the mythologies around Saturn. And Saturn is the outermost visible planet. And so Saturn became in myth, the boundary of the cosmos. And so Saturn is responsible for order. And
this would be like astrology type of theology, or what kind of?
Yeah. So like the ancient Greeks were noticing what they called the wandering stars. So all of the stars rotate around Polaris, the North Star, except for these five bodies that they called wandering stars, which today, you know,
planets.
Yeah.
Like Stars, Jupiter, or Saturn, Jupiter, Mars. Okay.
Flash forward and maybe like it's now the year 1400, 1500 medieval Europe, and Christian theology has really become the dominant way of thinking in Europe. And so there is no longer space for like multiple gods. So Saturn, the time god, was transformed into the concept of Father Time. So Father Time's not a god, but he's still, you know, teaching sort of this discipline around time. Time is something that's not to be wasted. It's, you know, and
more as like a, like to pass it down from like an educational perspective and kind of create those old folks tales or, okay.
Yeah. And then, you know, another 200 or 300 years later, Europe enters into the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment was a period that was sort of punctuated by a few very famous thinkers. René Descartes, who was I Think, Therefore I Am.
Okay.
And this is something called the Cartesian division, which is really what I Think, Therefore I Am is stating, is that, like, you know, I exist because I have consciousness, and my consciousness is separate from yours and everything else. And so there, it creates this notion of like an observer and the observed.
Is that like hyper individualism? Yeah. Or okay? And so you and I in that scenario would be two completely individual
separate
beings, rather than like, you know, my Christian theology would be we are all like son of God. Is that, or like the son of man in the image of God as like a collective? Is that kind of a difference?
Okay. Yeah. So what was going on in the Enlightenment, and there were a few different thinkers, were just conceptualizing sort of like a framework to imagine a rational universe. And so another one was Newton. And Newton is like, you know, subatomic, the idea of like subatomic particles, and that, you know, at smaller and smaller measurable levels of reality, things are still separate. And from that, from some of those ideas came the Father Time transformed into what's called the Watchmaker God. And Newton and some of the other Enlightenment thinkers decided that, you know, sort of if the universe is this, you know, perfect mechanism, then that, like, you know, if you found a watch laying on the ground, that would imply that the watch had a watchmaker. Like, okay. And so basically time sort of transformed in sort of the 1700s into this idea that we exist in this perfect clock that God made. And so God must value time as something that's meant to be measured.
Okay. Whoa.
Yeah. And so
do you think that's what the Bible teaches? We see the Bible talk about value, but I don't think we see it talk about time too much.
Yeah. I don't know about in that sense. I know like early Judeo-Christian tradition was really responsible for the modern week. And the week is another funny thing because weeks is something that we entirely made up.
Totally.
There is no...
There could have been 100 weeks in a year. Yeah, totally. 103-day weeks, yeah. Some skips.
Yeah. So the week is an entirely fictitious structure that we made up. And
like, I think really 28-day periods make the most...
Yes.
Sense. Like that's at least what the most observable kind of function is. Have you seen the turtle shell?
Yeah.
But
you think about, you know, this thing about Saturn and being the boundary, and Saturday is Saturn's day. And Saturn's day is the boundary of the week.
The last day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So even now, Sabbath. We are worshiping Saturn. And,
wow.
Yeah.
We say worshiping. Is like the what do you mean? You mean observing? You mean worshiping? Yeah. Like how do you mean?
We are observing Saturn's day.
Right.
We look forward to it.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And so, would you say that is pre or post? Like when is the concept of, because like the Jewish and then now the Christian Sabbath is on Saturday.
Yeah.
A time to like you know slow down, reflect, spend time with God and your family. What? Is that pre or post, would you say, Saturn's day, Saturday?
Yeah.
And what is, like, English is not the first language. Like, what was it called? What is Saturday and what's the first language? Like, you know.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, it was always a reference to Saturn.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah, so originally, earlier, so Sunday and Monday still refer to the sun and the moon. But there were then, in sort of ancient Roman times, different names. Then today, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday have been replaced for Norse gods that also refer to the planets, but they, you know, like Thursday is Thor's day.
Okay. Well, Thor, like the hammer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what, so why him?
I actually don't know.
Okay.
I don't know that much about
it. You're blowing my mind right now, man. It's just like all these little, like tiny, all these little,
you know, when I went down the months train and like December is the 10th month, November, like November 9, October 8, like you can, you know, April being like the first of the month.
Yeah.
Or the first month of the year. Yeah, like this stuff is, it's either so much coincidence or like real.
Yeah. So we absorb these unquestioned beliefs and then they just start to evolve on their own. The month's names is a great example. And that, you know, going back to Bitcoin, right? Like Bitcoin offers us a timekeeping system that can't be arbitrarily changed, which is really important because you know, they have changed the names of months. They have changed the names of days. And they're not insignificant things. We just weren't around for them.
Right.
So we exist today in a system where the boundaries of time have been continually altered in ways that we can't even comprehend. That's just true. And it's a really deep rabbit hole, you know, and depending on how far you want to go, there's something called phantom time theory, which is acknowledged like in universities. Where there's a decent argument to be made that at least 300 years of European history are totally made up.
Not missing, but made up.
Yeah. Because certain people wanted to be alive or ruling during the millennial.
Like made up. So do you mean made up as in the victor wrote the story? Or do you mean made up like somebody like, in arrears just
like
made
it
up?
It was meant to be the year 600 and they're like, actually, it's the year 1000. And we all get to be alive during the year 1000 now because we're amazing. And
okay. Yeah. So is that made up or altered, would you say? Like, I mean, yeah, same. But I guess more what I'm getting at is like, if obviously if time can be altered in that way, then there's a case to be made for checking on timing of history. But you could assume like, if I did all the same things in the year 600 or the year 1000, it's still the same thing that happened and the timing is just off. But would you say that there's also events that are completely made up? And like history is written by the victor. But is there a case that some of the fathers that we, you know, look to just never existed? Or
yeah, there's a decent argument that, for example, Napoleon Bonaparte is not a real person. Okay. And never existed.
And what's his shtick?
So Napoleon was a French emperor who conquered all of Europe. Allegedly, around 1810.
Okay.
You know, in that time. So not that long ago, right? 200 years ago. And he's one of history's most famous figures, right? But his story, and I might get this not exactly right, but his story is about how many wives he had and how many sisters he had. It's like this exact story appears in ancient Egyptian mythology about other characters.
Interesting.
Yeah. I think that, you know, history is really edited. So things like, you know, we've been subjected to altered versions of history a lot longer than I think people even want to acknowledge now. And, you know, the one I love to harp on is like the moon landing, which is like, pretty sus.
It's pretty sus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We didn't go to the moon.
My favorite video of the moon landing is them filming the rover or whatever. What was it called? Like, it was called the rover, yeah. I assume. They're filming it taking off of the moon.
Oh, yeah. And who's taking the footage?
It's like, what? And it's moving. Someone is there. Like, something is moving the camera. It's like, did we just sacrifice that guy?
Yeah. Did they have remote control cameras from who was operating it? Yeah. I mean, and there's even like,
how do you get the footage? What did we go back and grab the SD card? Like,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, and like the lunar rover, the buggy itself, it couldn't have been operating a combustion engine because there's no air. So if it was using batteries, you know, batteries don't work very well in the cold and it's meant to be minus 200 on the moon. So
there's some science problems here.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I'm 45 now. So when I was six, the entire school, went to the gymnasium, just like every other school on, I think it was like a November day. And we watched the Challenger shuttle launch. Because there was Canadian on board and the Challenger shuttle exploded famously and traumatized every kid in North America. We all got to see the shuttle blow up and then go back to class and talk about it. And the Challenger was really like the original 9/11 because
like scaring people into basically confirmation.
After the Challenger, it was like space travel is way too dangerous. We're not even going to try to go to the moon anymore.
Well,
and
right.
They publicly executed moon landings.
So this is 20 years post moon landing?
Yeah, 17.
Yeah. 17?
Yeah. And, you know, and like interest in the moon landing was waning. The Soviet Union was bankrupt. There was lots of reasons to kind of like, but I think there was obviously the big problem of at some point people wanting to see, you know, settlements on the moon . So back it up, you know, and the event before that I knew about as a little kid from history was the Hindenburg. And the Hindenburg was a really famous and tragic explosion of a blimp that happened, and that was the end of blimp air travel.
This is like the recent one is the Titanic implosion.
Yeah, totally. So the Hindenburg was like, I don't know, 1935. And there's video footage of it. One blimp exploded and they're like, oh, blimps are too dangerous. No more blimp travel. And it was a very unquestioned event, you know, and now I look back at it as I look back at the moon landing and I'm like, wow, they just publicly executed blimp travel. And, you know, because they, you know, there's a lot of records and, if, you know, you can find a lot of stuff online that suggests that blimp travel was actually a lot more wide, a lot more common in the 19th century than we've been led to believe. Mm. And there are problems with that because it kind of contradicts the story we've been told about the evolution of flight technology and the Wright brothers.
I have never thought about this. Blimps had no wings, but were just giant helium.
No. And this is the crazy thing is like the blimps were actually like really advanced flying craft. And
is this a fact that we've observed or is this?
So there are schematics and stuff and, you know, inside the big blimps, and the big blimps were humongous. You know, they're the size of like Carnival cruise ships. Mm. And inside them is like a cruise ship inside the balloon.
Like dorms and
And like, you know, restaurants and it was luxury.
Wow. And did we travel? You figured humans traveled in the 19th century in blimp.
All over the place. All over the world.
Like to work or like to like how we'd take a 747 now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that it was airports create gating, right? They're like control mechanisms for herding people, passport control, all this stuff. You know, I've seen it suggested that like blimps would just dock. Blimps could park anywhere, could dock anywhere.
What's the power? Like how are we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know.
Okay. Yeah. Like what powers the Goodyear blimp at the golf tournaments?
Yeah, I don't know that. Okay. Yeah. NASA has control of like the dominant supply of the world's helium. So you couldn't even like start a blimp competitor, you know, if you wanted to get into commercial blimp.
Yeah, commercial blimp seems like a vibe, man. Yeah.
No.
Can't do it. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because blimps would theoretically like, I think, be able to travel like an unlimited distance. They could go anywhere. And so
blimps, are we talking like, would you say it's that same tech powering the Goodyear blimp?
Possibly, yeah. I haven't really like studied the
When's the book? We've got the Taoism, we've got the time, and then we need the blimps.
Maybe blimps.
Maybe blimps. The third one.
Yeah. So I don't know, man. I think that like there's a lot of what is so interesting to me about the time thing is because, you know, we can follow a path of how our way of thinking about it has changed, and we can mark certain things and use it as kind of like a way to evaluate where we are now. Some of those things are things like, you know, how much of history has been altered or rewritten.
What's the point of altering or rewriting history, do you think?
I think it's like what Orwell said in 1984. And it's that if you don't know where you're going or if you don't know where you came from, right?
He who controls the present controls the past, and he who controls the past controls the future. So it's purely a control mechanism, you'd say. And we're saying, you and I have both said it, and I catch myself whenever I say it because I don't know the answer here. Is they changed the clocks? They you know who's they? Like in you know, and I don't think we're ever gonna know.
Yeah,
but you know, that's the speculation.
You know, I do believe that we get shown certain things. One that has always stood out to me is this. Do you ever watch Lost?
No, I'm familiar with the concept. It was a big deal when it ended, right? Everyone was sad.
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of like, you know, at the start of it, everybody wakes up on an island. They've got amnesia. But I think one person did not have amnesia. And it's like...
In Lost, this is the plot?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, like, you know, we all think that we're on this road together, traveling at the same pace. And it's possible that there's a group of people who
have the keys, so to speak. Okay. And like, are we talking like Rothschilds, like the, you know, the Jekyll Island crew?
You know, I think like if you've heard their name, it's not them.
Mm, whoa.
So I think it's probably, you know, even beyond that.
And so what makes them like, would you equate this back to, and we haven't really dove into like your theology much, but like, you know, the audience will know I'm like a Christian. I don't know. You and I have tried a little bit of spirituality. I'm not sure what you like, how you'd, if you would label yourself, but like, you know, the Christian kind of theology here would be like Satan has certain grips over the earth? You think that's like the keys, that's the key holder?
You know, I think there's pretty overwhelming evidence that people who are on TV are definitely putting forth satanic imagery. And it happens so regularly that it's hard to make a case that it's a coincidence. And I mean, overtly satanic.
Right.
You know, so it's, you don't accidentally dress up as a devil. Right. You know, it's just.
Yeah, the hand one I can get by sometimes.
Have you ever done this by accident?
Not that one, no. Yeah. But like, you know, like you've held your hands like a certain way. What's this one is the, or what, there's the triangle.
Yeah.
There's, I forget what the, I'm not versed in my Satan imagery. But like, there's a few that I think get stretched, but to your point, like, yeah, it happens more than you'd think. So then let's game theory this out. Like, is this God's, you know, God's given us free will. My thesis here is like, God's given us free will, us including the devil, but he's kind of, you know, the only person he's restricted, funny enough, is the devil. And he's given the devil certain rules that he has to play within. He's maybe given man like the physical rules of the earth. He's given the devil these like spiritual overt rules, meaning like you can't, you know, you can't deceive them, or you can, but they have to have the opportunity to like, you know, and like, I think we've seen clearly in the Bible, the devil has to ask God's permission to punish certain. Job is a great example where it's like, you know, even I was reading actually yesterday, like when Jesus is telling Peter that he's going to betray him, Jesus tells Peter, the devil has asked for you. And so you're about to like do this heinous sin is kind of like the messaging that we read in the book of John. And I'm just like, is this who they is? Is this the they that we refer to? Or what's your take on, you know, the power that, like, who gets to hold the keys? This seems like a big, you get to change history, you get to change the time, you get to change the money, you get to change the air travel, yeah. Hide the moon landing. Like, what, you know, why? Who gets that power? Yeah. To what end?
Yeah. I think, yeah, there's, you know, whether or not they're like directly communing with that entity or just worshiping it, I don't know if I have like a strong opinion about that, but I think that, yeah, it's alien, you know, it's an alien way of thinking for most average people who don't have some kind of like innate desire to dominate other people. And like, yeah, yeah. So if you don't have that, then you would think the idea that some people or large groups of people do would be like kind of absurd. But if there were people that were kind of like worshiping that sort of like dark power, they would probably think very differently to how the average person does. And that could be the easiest way of explaining it, you know, without getting too like metaphysical about it.
Right.
I do think that there are people who absolutely worship the devil.
Right.
Whether or not they're able to like access something beyond it. I think that there is, you know, a lot of power in ritual and ceremony and belief, and immeasurable power, you know, in all ways.
Yeah.
And your relationship to God or your others, you know, and so they're probably experiencing certain insights, certain.
Well,
you know, I think that there would be playing by a different playbook.
Different playbook. Yeah. Interesting. And so how do you rectify that? And how do you think, like, are you familiar with the term Calvinism? Like this kind of like deterministic versus free will type of thought process. Like, that brings me to a place, or I run the risk of being brought to a place of just like apathy and, you know, whatever. Why bother? Someone's got the rule book and gets to play, you know, gets to change the rules whenever they want. Do you feel the same, and how do you rectify that?
Yeah. I mean, like, we were never promised like the game was fair.
Yo. Right. Good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, that's a really good point. The Bible shows time and time again of like unfair, you know, treatment of good people. And
good things happen to bad things.
Literally the only thing the Bible shows is like at the root, it's the sovereignty of God and like, you know, God's plan pursuing. Would you say, like, talk about the Bible, history's altered. Would you say the Bible is another like altered document, or yeah.
I mean, I think the Bible is heavily edited
in like all of it. Cause there's, if you know, Wes Huff, have you heard of him?
No.
He's a Christian apologetic, and he'll like relate the stone tablets back. No, I mean, I'm trusting him because I can't read the stone tablets, nor have I seen them, to be fair. I just, you know, I saw him on Instagram. I was like, that aligns with what I think. So I'm going to go ahead and like just borrow this. But he's made claims of certain books being like 99%, like word for word translation based on like stone tablets found in, you know, water and yeah. like whatever. So what part of the Bible would you say is like doctored or?
Yeah. I mean, and so this is what I know, but what do I know?
Yeah.
I mean, the King James Bible is like 400 years old.
Yeah.
Right. And so even like this problem with phantom time theory, there might be an extra 300 years missing there that didn't happen. We're talking about hundreds of years between the production of the King James Bible, you know, and the refining of the, we'll say the modern Bible, which was like 300 years after the time of Jesus' death. 300 years, a really long time. And then you're going to tack on another 1300 years, or, you know, so we're talking about a really long period of time. There are a lot of, you know, there are, you know, like the Book of Enoch, there are books that have been potentially omitted over time. Yeah. So part of what's gone on with that is a decision about
it's centralized decision making
which books got to be in the Bible.
Yeah. You know, the reason I looked it up, I think the reason that Enoch was not included, I think, was because there was inconsistencies within the book. And I haven't read the full book. I listened to it on 2X. Have you ever listened to that book on 2X? Yeah. Dude, if you need dopamine, that's the way to do it. Yeah. And I think also, and this is where, you know, to your theory here, it contradicted with other books in the Bible, which always puts my like red flag up. I personally believe the Bible to be the divine word of God. Yeah. I would probably believe in an unedited Bible, but whether it's edited or not, doesn't change my faith, but it is an interesting thought experiment to run down like what you're saying, like Book of Enoch. Why isn't that in there?
Totally. I mean, in like Mary Magdalene and right. I mean, there's a whole aspect of the Jesus story that has also been omitted. So yeah, I mean, I think, you know, multiple things can be true at the same time. And, you know, the Bible can be the word of God, and it can also be someone's editing version of it.
Right. Yeah. This multiple things being true at once is a foreign and recent concept that I've been like this concept of like Calvinism. It's a recent kind of like discovery of mine. And you know, I'm pretty certain the Bible teaches free will, like on the macro. If you read it, you read like God created, gave humans the manual, told us, you know, love me and you'll win, defy me and you'll lose, like make your choice. Yeah. And there's other verses on the micro in the Bible talking about predestination, which is where the Calvinist kind of thesis comes in. And I don't know. It's like, both of these are biblical. Like, you know, you've got two opposing viewpoints, both being showcased. And that's it's been a wrestle point of mine lately. And cause I'm trying to align, like I've got to make decisions. What do I think? What do I teach my kids? How do I live my family? Like all this stuff. It's just it's such an interesting thing. And so what I landed on is that I just think God gets to be two things at once. Cause he's, you know, God, the creator, and like he gets to defy physics. And that's the best I can do, which is like kind of a cop out answer.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. It's interesting. It's a really interesting thought experiment to start, you know, diving down the what is these like really deep. This is why I think talking to Bitcoiners is so interesting, because we can sit here and talk about time and the moon landing and the ancient buildings. And we acknowledge that when things are historically have been faked, it really poses problems for the future. And, it's an interesting, kind of thought process, but
yeah, you know, and I think that one of the cool things that Bitcoin does, which connects Bitcoiners, is establish a baseline expectation for things to make sense. You know, if you've now, it's a paradigm, right? It's like if money should make sense, Like, okay,
right. Yeah.
Time should make sense too.
Right.
We can do this with other stuff.
Yeah.
So it becomes then an operating system, right? It's a way of like viewing like the rational world to me. And that's why I love talking about to Bitcoiners, because it becomes a frame of reference. It's a point of like commonality, where if we can agree on this one thing, we can probably at least have a conversation about how other things should be this or that.
Yeah. What is it in society that there's a host, and like things that I talk about, I'm sure, and I hope that this show gets to run for decades. I hope that I get to explore unique concepts with people that I disagree with, people that I agree with. You know, I can't think of anything off the top of my head that I disagree with you with, but like you and I have disagreed in the past, and I think that's healthy. I think it's good. And I think I love that. Like, I've never once been offended by you. I'm not sure if I've offended you, but you seem like you got thick skin. And so you're probably fine. Like, you know, and that's just good. It's healthy. That, which is also like Bitcoiners, I think, align with that. Bitcoiners and German and French people, I think kind of you can chat with them and not offend them. But why in Western culture do we just live in a society where there's just taboo? Like, half the people are in outrage about the moon landing. If you claim it's fake, or if you claim it's real, like you can't have a reasonable conversation. The shape of the earth is like a big taboo topic that you can't. The minute you start exploring that, you just become an alienated psycho. You know, money, vaccines, like all the, there's just all these taboo, and they're growing by the second. It feels like, which is the detriment of our society. Where does this? Is it the same people? It's the same they? It's the people that wrecked the history and the time and the money? They're all like wrecking they're making us thin skinned? Or like, what's the consequence of this? Or what's the outcome of this?
You know, I actually think, and this is the topic of time for me has become like, I'm so interested in it.
Yeah.
Because this artificial thing that started out as a boundary, right? Time became a way.
Started out, you mean like Saturn?
Yeah.
That started out? Okay, yeah.
So Saturn, the boundary of like the cosmos, transformed into Saturn, the boundary of like, you know, how we manage our day. And that's like a made up thing, right? But the notion of what a boundary is a made up thing that has, you know, like, it's like a pen. It's an intellectual pen for you to be caged in or around something, right? So all of the things that you're talking about are, you know, people reacting to discovering a boundary, right? It's like a container. You've been told a certain thing about the shape of the earth, about a vaccine, a medical procedure. Those are all boundaries, right? And I think when people experience a really visceral emotional reaction to a boundary, often it's because they're for the first time brushing up against something they didn't realize was there.
Interesting.
Yeah. And this is why time is a great one. In the same way that Bitcoin helps illuminate the ludicrousy of our monetary system, time is a really easy one to understand, because nobody today can completely ignore the concept of time. Okay. And we treat it as though it is completely absolute and it's totally made up. One of the craziest things, so it got me really thinking about this in the first place. I might have told you this. We were talking about the book last time, but even our concept of what we think the present moment is actually not true.
Hit me through because you this messed me up actually. We met a few weeks ago. Yeah. So walk me through this.
Yeah. So your brain receives a number of different signals from all of your organs that take in sensory information: touch, smell, sight, taste. And those signals arrive to the brain at different times. So sight is faster than touch. And so your brain's job is to synchronize those inputs and produce for you a coherent and, you know, like a sensible experience of the present moment. And so to do that, it delivers that moment to you at a latency of a few tenths of a second.
Wow.
So we don't actually experience the present moment as it's happening now. It's buffered, so that we don't look like we're watching a Chinese dubbed movie.
With lifts moving at a different time then. And so,
even your concept around determinism.
And you're not talking about like frame rate on a film. You're talking about my actual eyeballs right now compared to my...
So we've been lied to by our own brains that what we're experiencing is real time. And it's not. we are experiencing a tape delay. It's just a very slight tape delay. But
does that open up for you? My mind immediately went to time travel. And I have no idea where I land time travel. What's the, you are like, you are probably one of the most philosophical people that I've met. So what's, I want your take on, what is it? What's your take?
So I've been studying a lot about, you know, in preparation to write the book, I've probably read 20 books on time, physics of time, the different ideas around like, you know, so there's like this really sort of opposite ends of the spectrum as, you know, is time a fundamental force in the universe, the same way like magnetism is? Or is time a function of how our brains process information? And we experience the ordering of events basically in the same way a blockchain works, where information is brought in, it's pruned into a single chain, blocks are added. Right. Like that's really...
Yeah, I would probably align with the latter.
Like, so that wouldn't actually require some kind of force, like a river flowing through the universe that flows forward. Like, you know, it, those things don't necessarily both need to be real. Mm-hmm. And it's possible that what we think of as time, as like, you know, a lot of people would sort of imagine this linear forward river that started with the Big Bang theory and now we're here, whatever you're, you know, that's not actually a thing, you know, and it's called the user illusion. How we're constructing our understanding of the present moment could be much more significant and structural in the sense that what we may actually think of as reality is just our brain's continual ordering of information into a coherent narrative.
Coherent narrative, like meaning our brains aren't smart enough to figure out the reality, and so we print it down a little bit.
So it would be more like all of the different, the collection of all the different information that our brains take in and turn into what we think is this conversation happening right now. You could think of it like when you open up your laptop, you see windows and icons on those windows, and your understanding of what's happening on the computer is based on what you see on the screen.
GUI.
But that's not actually what's actually happening in the computer at all.
Ones and zeros.
Yeah. And so we may be much more than just seeing the, you know, the experience of reality on delay. What we're experiencing is a compression of information into an output that our brains relate to us, to our consciousness. In this unified system that we think of as life or reality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whoa.
You know, this is the first time I've really talked about any of this stuff. So.
Yeah, man. No, I appreciate that, man. And I am so deeply fascinated in things that people don't talk about. And one thing I find, again, like back to Bitcoiners, is that they just have rabbit trails in the ground. Yeah. Like, totally. There's very few people in Kelowna or in Alberta or in Canada or in the world that you can just explore unique concepts with. And yeah, I don't know where, I've never thought about this at all. But you didn't, I'm not sure, like time travel.
Oh yeah.
So with all that, how do we rectify a time travel?
Yeah.
Like, so, narrative or otherwise.
Yeah. So, you know, the idea that you could travel to different points in time sort of assumes this concept that time is a river.
So time not linear, but time as a construct, you're saying, is just like completely abstract?
Like, we're potentially just not even real. There aren't great arguments. Like, you know, I think that, you know, physics has tried to turn sort of time and gravity into a single thing. And there were going to be some physicists watching. That's not exactly what you
know. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. You're talking macro, like it's
difficult to prove that time is this thing that is a part of the way the universe works. And
other than observational, which your argument is lagging anyways.
Yeah.
Like it's, your observation is disconnected. So observational evidence is kind of no longer valid.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so there's another theory that's called about time called the block universe theory, which supposes that time, what time actually is, are like a series of successive snapshots of the configuration of everything. Like if you could just imagine like continuous Polaroids being taken of all of everything all at once. Okay. But that all of the Polaroids already exist side by side.
Calvinism.
Yeah. And so they're not linear like we think.
Predetermination.
Yeah. And so...
So are we a movie that is already written and we're just playing ourselves?
And this is where it gets back to user illusion, right?
Right.
It's hard for us, you know, it's worth thinking about, you know, where you might stop to say is like, okay, so it's, I live my life on 200 basis points of a second delay. That's fine. But it could be much more significant than that. And it could be that all of this exists already and that our brain is just organizing it for us away in it so that we can understand it. And we're just watching it.
And does that promote or like devalue a God, a creator? And I guess someone had to make the movie, but like, what are your thoughts on? Is this a theory that you believe? Or is this a theory that you've heard? And you know, these are pretty outside the box. So totally. Feel free to like omit.
What do I think about it? I think that so. Firstly, you know, the separate of time. I think that consciousness, as we think about it, is off. So I think that our brains are more like two-way radios than they are like hard drives. And I think that our consciousness is actually mostly not local to our, what we think of as our brain.
Our consciousness not local to our brain.
So who Adam is, isn't stuff that aren't files that are stored in here.
Right.
I think we have some way to retrieve, to download files from.
Would you say that like, that doesn't seem too far out. Like that's your soul. That's your, have you played with Claudebot?
I haven't, you know, it's,
so I set one up and it's running. You probably can see the little Mac Mini there. And there's actually a file called soul.md and you can literally program the soul and it's separate from like the hard drive, as you say. It's like, it's its own being. It's its own thing. The soul. Yeah. So yeah, anyway, sorry, I cut you off.
Yeah, no. So I mean, we were talking about Newton earlier and Descartes, and Newton and Descartes came together to form this view of Western conception of the universe, that everything is separate. And from that, we think that we are all individually separate beings, which also in the grand scheme of human thinking is a pretty new idea. You know, and people going back earlier didn't think that way. You know, Martin Luther didn't think that way. Like, I think that a lot of ideas... This is also part of the narrative in the book, is that time is just one example of something that is a pretty new idea that collectively we've stopped questioning and decided that it's decided, you know?
The months, the calendar, the time, the money even for most people.
Yeah. And so, yeah, what do I think? I think that we all live in a... We're sharing some kind of experience together that... And I think that experience is God. And we are, you know, this is the thing, is like, we're in it now. It's like,
right.
You know, I think that we, yeah, I mean, maybe one of the more out there, I think the Bible is more of a manual on how to experience that thing that's happening right now, as opposed to aspects of it happening, you know, after the afterlife. Or, you know, I think it's, and I'm speaking obviously broadly, but it's like, figurative in the sense that like we think some of these things are literal and it's more that it's meant to be, maybe it's a manual for how we're supposed to understand this thing that's happening
right
in our brain.
And so how do you like, so I think parts of the Bible, that's like the Bible's, if you only read the Bible as a self-help book, you'd win. It's like, you know, eat good food. You know what it actually says? This is interesting. I've been on this like diet journey. Not like I'm not dieting, but like just what do I eat? And it says like bushes or vegetables are for the animals, and the animals are for the humans, and the humans and the animals can eat fruit. It's kind of like the rounded up. Like, you know, pork and shellfish are bad. It's like, well, we know that they're full of parasites. Like, it's like, yeah, if you're sick, don't go in your community. Like, this stuff just all, it's like, yeah, it kind of makes sense.
Stay away from your neighbor's wife.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, yeah, this, all of this makes a lot of sense. But then what I found deeply interesting and what I've been reading a lot more of is like the prophecy and seeing. And so granted, I haven't verified it myself. Just like, I don't run every one of my Bitcoin transactions through my node, but I'm like certain they're on the blockchain.
Don't.
I know. What kind of a maxi am I? But it's like, allegedly, and I believe this to be true, there are documents written that are fulfilled by certain other historical events that are also, like, again, allegedly, which I believe to be true, real events. And so, you know, if Bible is only but a manual for how to live, and time or, and God is like the moment kind of idea, where does the prophecy come in your, and maybe it's something you haven't, like, you know, like, I don't, like, again, I don't, I'm not like meaning to like push or anything.
No, it's just, yeah. I'm always happy for the question. I don't know if I have an answer for that one. Mm. Yeah.
Gotcha. No, just kidding. Yeah.
Stumped.
Yeah. No, hardly. Yeah. That's one thing. Like I've said this multiple times, like I am in the pursuit of objective truth. And this is why I believe in Jesus Christ. This is why I believe Bitcoin is the superior asset on the planet. Because like, and really those are the two like objective truths that I can kind of find in the world. But it's like, you know, the second you can show me that like Jesus isn't the king of, you know, the universe, then like I'm out. You know, I'm not going to worship anyone other than the king of the universe, the creator of the earth, etc. And I think it's so cool that, you know, the God that I worship, like, encourages these questions. You see the people throughout biblical history, like, lamenting with God, you know, questioning him, and he's always happy to answer. It's the apathetic ones, the ones that are just like, you know, not that he kind of punishes. I just think it's like an interesting anecdote. But all that to say, my questions here are like, they're not in a combative way. They're like in a pursuit of theory I have not considered, and running that through the framework of like what I believe and, you know, if it matches or not. Cause it's, yeah, like I said, I'm willing to question everything. Like, you know, I'm happy to question the shape of the earth, and I'm happy to question the moon landing, and I'm happy to question vaccines. And thank goodness I question the money. Like, you know, how much I think the society is worse the more that we move towards a pattern of, well, time is time. And here we go. And like, you know, to most people, and like, you sound nuts. But that's cool. Like, I think it's important to have real theory behind like complicated abstract topic. And, yeah, I think it's cool. How far is the book? When's the book?
Yeah, we're targeting, April 8th release date.
What's, is there significance there?
It's a solar eclipse.
Okay.
Yeah.
Man, you need a little Easter eggs. Hey?
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
For you, solar eclipse.
Yeah. I'm just kind of in the editing process right now, and the book's
so it's up. Written.
Yeah.
It's there. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. I learned this going through the last book that I wrote. Writing the book is like, you know, the first half of the job.
Okay.
Yeah. And yeah. Most of the real, you know, fruit comes in like after the first draft is done.
Yeah.
So really, yeah, the book's called Age of Time.
Age of Time.
Yeah.
Ooh, good
it's
name.
A journey through time consciousness and the end of the modern illusion.
And would you say, is this a like sequel to the Tao? It's completely separate. Lots of your Tao principles though. I must like, do they line up or no?
Yeah. So the, I would say like the intellectual thought progression on how this all started was I started really getting into Bitcoin and noticing what Bitcoiners describe as time preference. And I just had different language for it because in Taoism, that's just called being in the present moment.
Right. Is Taoism a practice or a belief?
Yeah, it's kind of both.
Both, okay.
Yeah.
And that comes from your time in China, I assume? Yeah. Like that, would you say that, like, that shaped you?
Actually, my interest in it predated my time in China.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay. Is that what drove you to China?
Partly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. So the Tao of Bitcoin is about what I call Bitcoin is putting words, like very ancient words, to what Bitcoiners think they're experiencing when they are having a different relationship with the now. And what I feel is happening there is that the alleviation of money stress widens your temporal apparatus, your ability to be present. And Taoist people who are, you know, practicing Taoists can do this without having to be orange pilled.
Right.
And so this is basically what.
Who is a Taoist? Like a monk? Is that a?
It is people who practice. Like it's a religious philosophical tradition
okay.
from, you know, hundreds of millions of people.
Yeah.
So and it really is. It's about.
Wait, are you in that group of people?
Yeah.
You said
yeah. 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 Cool. What's cool about Taoism? It's not.
Are you a card-carrying Taoist?
Yeah, it's not
a born-again Taoist?
It's not exclusory because right. there aren't any figures, right? It's not like a... It's not a theology.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just a belief that there is a unifying force that guides all things and brings all things together into like a sort of like the natural order of things is oneness. And how people can best like commune with that experience is by... being fully present.
Mm.
So, it just happens that I think Bitcoin is something that can give people a similar, you know, some kinds of the experience can be felt in a similar way. Mm. Where the time thing came from was, you know, when I really started to think on it, I realized that there is an underlying mechanism that is driving that change in the experience of time for people who are aligning themselves to Bitcoin's clock. And in the book, I make the argument that what is going on is that the operating system that it gets installed, the factory system you get installed at birth, which is clock time, has been, you know.
Are we installed that at birth or do we just inherit that right away?
I think we no
like babies are clockless.
Yeah,
like they're remarkable.
clock time is installed like when you're waiting for recess in grade two.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like we
even waiting for in our like we're guilty of this. Like we have a breakfast time.
Yeah.
We have a lunch time. And we have like it's not just you're hungry, go eat. That is like that would be madness with the four kids. Like
totally. And you guys like anybody else are just acting out the operating system.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when a different operating system is installed, a different conception of time is possible. And, you know, then this like, it's not Bitcoin people don't stop using watches. I mean, you guys are a great example, right? It's just a different interaction with, you know, that concept of accelerationism. In the clock time world, there is basically no endpoint to the division of your attention span, right? We went from like watching 1 minute videos on Instagram to like 1 second videos on TikTok.
Yeah.
And it's like, I watched this clip the other day of like using Speechify at like 800 words per second, showing how fast your brain can actually, and I'm like,
process.
Where do you need to go to? Why? Yeah.
All in the name of efficiency.
Yeah.
I was having, speaking of ClaudeBot, I've been for 2 days setting up this ClaudeBot, like talking to it basically and slowly having to figure out, you know, what it's actually going to be useful for. And I was driving today and for the last 2 days when I've been driving, I've been talking to it, like telling it to ask me questions to make it more useful for me. And I was driving, and I didn't really have anything to say to it. And I was like, oh, what a waste of a drive. It's just like I'm fried. Like I'm broken. Like this is a fundamental problem that I need to change, whether it's like dopamine addiction or like what have you. But I was just like, what kind of a thought is that? And so to your point, like, yeah, we are. And what I said earlier, I suppose, like devolving, at least our brain capacities are. And so it's a cool construct to like try to sort out.
Yeah.
Do you think, go ahead.
Information is accelerating at a rate that exceeds the, you know, the physical limitations of the human mind's ability to adapt. And this is a fundamental problem of modernity. And I think this will come to a head because, you know, AI is essentially like the infinite compression of time, instant everything.
Literally, man, yeah. It's shocking.
Yeah.
So, okay. So
mind melting.
So what's like, you know, what's your book? Do you have a takeaway? In the bind, here I am, the dopamine man, asking to give away the end so I don't have to read it. But like, you know, what is the end game? And then including in that, like, you know, recent advancements in AI, like it is something that would have taken me hours, if not days to do. I'm getting in seconds. And I think weeks don't take days. Like things, they compresses even more infinitely the longer something would have taken.
Yeah.
How does that relate to your concept in the book?
I mean, I think that we're going to see like the exponentiality of this. It unfold in a very short amount of time. I was like, I don't know how many people have really contemplated what the world will be like when your Claude bot is actually smarter and more capable than you.
100%, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's...
Well, paired up with the freaking actual robot walking around, like we're entering into uncharted dangerous... I'm not sure if this is the fourth or the fifth turning at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
We're both at once.
Yeah, we're not talking about like 10 years from now. Like this like maybe this year.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a Bitcoin book. I think that basically... The only thing that we can do is try to build cognitive patterns and practices that will help insulate you from this like rampant and relentless acceleration.
Lower your time preference, read more, write more.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that the thesis? Like that's the warning is like, yo, slow down, journal.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess someone have to read the book to figure it out.
Yeah, you're gonna.
Okay, last question before I unlock the door and let you out of here. But what is your like daily practice? Like someone, I perceive you as being quite stoic, and like you strike me as a guy that probably meditates or like does like what practices are you observing today that are feeling like you're helping you? Speaking to someone who's like dopamine addicted and, you know, feels bad, but doesn't talk to this Claude bot for 10 minutes.
You know, I'm actually brutal. I have like a really overactive mind and I don't sleep a lot and I find my mind is very busy. The one practice I will say is that I force myself to read physical books.
Instead of on a Kindle or on a...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I read a lot. Like we don't own a TV. You know, we don't own a TV. So we never watch anything.
Yeah.
I actually don't think any amount of TV is safe for anyone.
Would agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And...
At best, it's brain rot.
At best. But I think it's quite damaging. And so, you know, that phenomenon you described, I'm subject to it too. After two or three pages of reading, you know, I have the urge to look at my phone. And so like I'm actively trying to retrain my brain because I could do this 20 years ago before we were all hyper addicted to like
a box. PC.
Yeah. Yeah. To like expand my concentration horizon. Mm. Yeah. And so I read a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good for you. What's the most impactful thing you've read in the last, I guess it's all been books about time.
Yeah.
In the last few months.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they are all books about time. I don't know if any of them in particular like super stand out. That one book that I mentioned is called The User Illusion. That
got on Audible. Maybe I'll pick up the physical copy though.
The User Illusion is an awesome read, man. It's like
I'll check it out. Any last thoughts you want to dive into?
Yeah, I don't know. I that's a question I never know how to answer.
Yeah, I know.
You know, if
it's
you're
terrible. I gotta think of a better way to end it.
If you're listening and you are interested in this. My other book, The Tao of Bitcoin, is available on Amazon, and you can find it at Lantern Bitcoin, which is my personal website. And yeah, Age of Time is coming out April 8th.
Come on. Okay. Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
Thanks so much for watching my conversation with Scott. I have a blast talking to Bitcoiners, talking to people smarter than me, talking to people with different interests from me. And yeah, man, this concept of time blows my brain to bits. The fact that we have an opportunity to actually dive into these complex topics is just so incredible, so fascinating. Again, I really, really enjoy speaking with other Bitcoiners who have these kind of complex topic expertises. I'm super pumped to read Scott's book, and I hope that you will also check it out. Once again, you know, this community of truth seekers amongst the Bitcoin community, they're so knowledgeable on this diverse amount of topics. And yeah, this show is going to hopefully touch every single one of them. For those of you that don't know me, welcome. Thanks for sticking it out this long in the episode. My name is Adam O'Brien. I'm the founder and CEO of a publicly traded Bitcoin company called Bitcoin Well. And I'm also the co-founder and CEO at a media company called GetBase. Above all, I'm a follower of Jesus, husband to my beautiful wife, Christina, and father to our four, almost five kids. I'm here to relentlessly pursue objective truth. And I want to find different ways to lead a more biblical life and ultimately point my family towards generational faith and prosperity. If any of this interests you, you need to subscribe right now. We have these conversations, these types of conversations every single week. And I would love to hear from you in the comments down below. So yeah, without further ado, I'll see you next week.